It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back tomorrow. Coming up later in the program, the American Academy of Pediatrics just released a new policy statement in favor of starting the school day later for teens. We'll talk to the children's sleep expert behind the new policy. First, oral arguments took place today in a federal appeals court over Wisconsin's same-sex marriage law. The state is appealing a federal judge's June decision overturning that marriage ban. WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson is in Chicago at the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, where the hearing took place. He joins us now to discuss what happened in those oral arguments. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So a quick background, how do we get here?
How did we get here? Well, I guess you could go way back to 2006 when the Wisconsin legislature put an item on the ballot banning gay marriage. The voters supported it. More recently, the ACLU filed a federal lawsuit challenging the ban, saying that it violated gay couples' rights to equal protection. And, you know, their U.S. constitutional rights. They prevailed in U.S. District Court in early June. Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that the ban was indeed unconstitutional. There was about a week there where gay couples were getting married before Crabb stayed her ruling pending this appeal. And so that's what brought us here today. Wisconsin's case was before a three-judge panel at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And they were joined by Indiana, plaintiffs from Indiana, and attorneys for the state of Indiana defending that state's gay marriage ban. It was also recently struck down in district court and is up for appeal.
So at these oral arguments, you had representatives of both states and of the plaintiffs in both cases. Is that right?
Yeah, you did. So for Wisconsin, you had a deputy an assistant attorney general. You had a solicitor general from Indiana, both making similar arguments. If you were expecting it to be, if it went as the schedule said it would go, you'd have sort of this many minutes for the plaintiff's attorney, this many minutes for the defendant's attorney. They both make their cases. It's just not the way it went. I mean, we're about a minute into arguments before Judge Posner, who is a Reagan appointee to the bench, just ripped in to the Indiana attorney and really began questioning, you know, what was the rational basis for laws that ban gay marriage. Did the same thing with Wisconsin's assistant attorney general over and over again, pressing him, saying, what is the rational basis for this law? Who is it helping? And in fact, isn't it hurting gay couples? And in particular, Posner was, very clearly swayed by the argument that banning gay marriage hurts children of loving gay parents who can't get married.
Right. And a lot of times in these oral arguments, we're kind of trying to look for these really subtle signs. It sounds like there were giant billboards in this.
It was amazing. I mean, you're exactly right. You're looking for anything in oral arguments. You're looking for a hint. And attorneys always caution you, don't read too much into what judges say in oral arguments. They're there to be the, you know, kind of devil's advocate. They're there to pick apart what they see as the weakest part of an attorney's argument. That doesn't necessarily mean that they think the entire argument is weak. But Posner was just relentless. I mean, he came back to the same points over and over again. Visually, I mean, there are no cameras in the courtroom, so you can't exactly say, go watch his facial expressions, but he was clearly unimpressed by the arguments from the assistant attorney general from Wisconsin and Indiana's solicitor general. He was annoyed. He kept telling them, give me a basis for why you have this law, and their reasons that, it was to uphold tradition, the tradition of marriage, or that it was, to encourage raising children in married families. Those just didn't set well with Posner, and he really wanted to press this point of what about these gay couples who want to wed? What about their children? Aren't they better off? And why are you stopping that?
Now, that's the one Republican appointee alongside two Democratic appointees. As you pointed out, questions during oral arguments are not the decision. But
yes,
tea leaf readers looking at those questions are probably thinking this suggests that the judges are going to rule against the states, against the same-sex marriage bans.
Yeah, if you're gonna read tea leaves, I mean, it seems like this would be a case to do it. And again, attorneys for the plaintiffs, they said good questions were asked, but they wouldn't come out and say, well, obviously, we won this one. But if you look at the way court decisions have been coming down recently, especially since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, I think plaintiffs feel like it's just a matter of time before they're ultimately victorious in, you know, striking down laws like Wisconsin's or Indiana's, you know, whether they were added to the Constitution by voters as they were here in Wisconsin or whether they're added to the statutes by the legislature as they were in Indiana. You know, plaintiffs feel like this is just the way that the legal system is going, and I imagine that they will point to, you know, arguments today in front of Judge Posner in particular, and, you know, presumably Judge Posner will make some of the same points whenever that panel issues a written decision.
So that's the action inside the courthouse. I understand that before the hearing there were rallies outside. Who was there? What was going on?
Yeah, you had plaintiffs from the Indiana and Wisconsin cases arrived in Chicago last night, and they rallied outside the federal courthouse. The ACLU, you know, I'm much more familiar with the Wisconsin case, but, you know, they obviously picked their plaintiffs very carefully. They are people who can point to tangible situations where, you know, they've been in a dedicated relationship for a number of years, and because they can't, you know, legally call themselves a married couple in Wisconsin, they've been denied some benefit or another, or they've had some hardship to deal with. And, you know, for example, there were parents there. You know, if you are gay parents in Wisconsin, you can't both be legally considered parents. I mean, you can get many legal protections, but one of the parents is not going to be considered the same in the eyes of the law. So examples like that, I mean, they tried to find plaintiffs like that, and they showed up in Chicago last night to tell their story.
Looking ahead, whichever way the court rules, do you think either side would look at appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think a lot depends. I mean, Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen has been pretty consistent on this. He's given every indication that he is going to defend this law, you know, as long as it takes. This is something that he supports, and Van Hollen has said that he's constitutionally obligated to support it since it was added to the Constitution by the voters of Wisconsin. So, you know, you would presume that if this court were to rule against Wisconsin's gay marriage ban, Van Hollen would, you know, consider appealing it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course,
we have an election
coming up, right? And so we don't know who our next attorney general is going to be. If it's Waukesha County District Attorney Brad Schimmel, Republican, you know, perhaps he would share Van Hollen's views. If it's Jefferson County District Attorney Susan Happ, probably she would drop any appeal.
And then does the governor's office have an opportunity to lawyer up if the attorney general doesn't do that?
He would have that opportunity.
Assuming we have the same governor, of course.
Yeah, I mean, he's been just very much in step with Attorney General Van Hollen on this so far. I mean, the arguments that they're making are, you know, they really mirror each other. They're saying that they're obligated to do this, although, you know, they would, you know, now that they've fought at the district court level and the appeals court level, there's nothing that ties their hands to say we have to appeal this to a higher court.
Before we let you go, Sean, a timeline on this appeals court for a ruling?
Yeah, the federal court system kind of operates under its own schedule. And, you know, attorneys in these cases said the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals can move very quickly when it wants to. In this situation, they have an incentive to move quickly because they have cases like this moving forward all throughout the country. And, you know, if this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, they probably want it to all arrive at about the same time. But they're not under any timeline, and they didn't give us any indication of when they might rule.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, joining us from that Court of Appeals in Chicago. Yesterday, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a new policy statement on school day start times for teens. The nation's largest pediatricians group, the largest pediatricians group said 8:30 a.m. or later is the way to go for middle schools and high schools as a way to counteract chronic sleep loss among teens. Here to talk about this new policy statement is Dr. Judith Owens. She's the lead author of the AAP's new statement on school start times. She's the director of sleep medicine at Children's National Health System. Dr. Owens, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So you've got this new statement out. Before we get to the school start times, how big a problem do teens have with sleep?
Well, you know, we really consider this to be a public health crisis because the vast majority of teenagers in the United States do not get anywhere near the 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep that they require. And the problem with that is that there are many negative consequences associated with that chronic insufficient sleep, ranging from physical problems like an increased risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes, and high blood pressure, to mental health issues, an increase in symptoms of depression, and even in suicidal thoughts, safety concerns in regards to impairments related to drowsy driving and increased car accidents, as well as higher rates of sports-related injuries for student athletes. And finally, there are performance issues that have to do with lower grades, lower scores on standardized tests, decreased attendance rates, and even increased dropout rates.
We'll get into some of the different factors behind the sleep problem, but why school start times? Why is that such a big factor?
Well, because of some important biological changes that occur around the time that kids go through puberty. So around that time, they have a natural normal shift in their circadian rhythms, which is the body's clock that regulates when we sleep and when we're awake. So that there is a what we call a delay or a shift to a later normal fall asleep time. So the average teenager really has difficulty falling asleep much before 11 p.m. And so they're biologically programmed to wake at around 8 a.m., a time when many of them already have to be in school.
Right. I was thinking when I first heard this, why not just go with a 9:30 bedtime, problem solved? It's not that simple, you say, because of that circadian rhythm?
Absolutely. It's not that simple. You know, there are certainly environmental factors that contribute to late bedtimes in teenagers. Social networking, use of electronic media, caffeine consumption, et cetera. But you still can't trump that biological imperative that says, I'm not ready to fall asleep until 11 o'clock.
Schools have a lot riding in some cases on getting that early start, their whole transportation schedule, extracurriculars, athletics, that sort of thing. They need time for that to happen before dinner time. Is this just going to be too much for schools to handle, making the school start time later?
Well, you know, there have been some 1,000 high schools in about 70 school districts across the country, to our knowledge, that have successfully implemented these changes. And they range from urban to suburban to rural communities to large high schools, small high schools. And what we found in talking and interviewing and surveying many of these schools around the country is that a lot of the anticipated problems did not materialize or did not materialize to the extent that they anticipated. And communities adjust. You know, it's change is hard, and it's very important to give communities enough time to adjust their schedules, for families to make arrangements for childcare. there. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is such a critical issue in regards to long-term potential health consequences that I think it is worth the short-term pain for this very important long-term gain.
I dimly remember after high school often taking naps. Are naps and catching up on sleep on the weekend enough to counteract that sleep loss from the early start?
In the short run, strategic napping can be temporarily helpful for students. And when I say strategic, I mean short naps, 15 to 20 minutes in the mid to late afternoon. So they're not late enough or long enough to interfere with your ability to fall asleep that night. However, sleeping in on weekends is not a very good idea. Not only does that not improve your alertness level Monday through Friday when you most need it, but the practice of going to bed later and sleeping in till noon or 1 or 2 in the afternoon on the weekends actually makes that normal circadian shift even more exaggerated. So it's kind of like flying from New York to L.A. and back every weekend. You're asking your body to make a dramatic shift in sleep-wake patterns, and we know that that kind of circadian disruption in and of itself can have real health problems.
We're talking to Dr. Judith Owens about the American Academy of Pediatrics' new policy statement on school start times. They want high schools, middle schools to start later to get more sleep for teens. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Start middle school, high school later? Are your teenage kids or grandkids too sleepy all the time? Are you a teen? Are you getting enough sleep? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Judith Owens on starting school days later for teens to help them get more sleep. A lot of chronic sleep deprivation, she says, leading to some serious health problems, educational problems in the short and long term. We're taking your calls now. Do you think it's a good idea to start school days later? Why or why not? If you're the parent or the grandparent of a teen or maybe even a teen yourself, do you think this idea would help? Why or why not? Call in and let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We'll go to John with us now in Madison. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. Say, I was just kind of curious thinking about this. How do your studies explain away the high-performing students then? If this is a biological thing that's going on.
Well, in terms of your question is specifically about why students can perform well despite this?
I guess I would ask that. I'm not positive that I believe the premise. But, yeah, that would be a question. What does that say about all our high-performing students?
Gotcha. I think I get it, John. So some students are doing okay despite the current start time. Maybe this isn't such a problem.
Well, I think doing okay in the short run is not the same as having serious and significant health-related issues further on down the line. So for a lot of these students, the things may not come home to roost until 20 or 30 or 40 years later when they have more cardiovascular disease, they have more high blood pressure. There's even some suggestion that chronic sleep deprivation may contribute to conditions like Alzheimer's disease. Even though you can, in the short term, kind of overcome the effects and still manage to do well, the question about how this compromises long-term health, I think, is still a very, very important one and an open one.
John, thanks for that call. We'll go to Scott in Madison now. Scott, hi.
Hi there. I was just thinking that what they ought to do is actually make school days longer for all students, grade school and high school, and incorporate things like nap times, times for doing their studies homework-wise, doing their extracurricular activities and so forth during the day and then being home at night with their family. But like I say, incorporating some sleep time in that so that, you know, parents who are having to go to work and such like that don't have to worry about looking for daycare.
Interesting, Scott. Thanks. So kindergarten nap time extended through the senior year. I don't know if I could have slept in my junior high. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a tall order for the average adolescent. But I think it does point out that there are creative solutions that school districts have come up with to kind of deal with this problem, making a first period class, for example, an optional one or a study hall so that students don't have to come in as early. I think there are a lot of things that can be done in terms of making sure that students get out in the afternoon in time to pursue those important extracurricular activities and athletic activities. So each school district is a little bit different in terms of the challenges that they face, but none of these are insurmountable. And kind of just accepting that this is an important issue goes a long way in helping school districts come up with creative solutions.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Kyle on Facebook who says, this is a great idea. I know from personal experience that teenagers are barely functional by 10 a.m. I hope this is in place by the time my kids are teenagers for the sake of their mental and physical health and their academic success. Kyle, thanks for that comment. Are the dominoes falling? Dr. Owens, you mentioned a couple districts that have done this. Is this something that more places are considering doing?
I think there has been in the last several years a lot more interest in looking at this issue seriously. And certainly one of our hopes with the issuing of this policy statement is that it really starts a dialogue with school districts who currently start their high schools certainly before 8, but also before 8:30 as well, to really seriously consider this. We hear that comment all the time. I just hope this happens before my son or daughter is in high school, because I'm really anticipating that this is going to be very difficult for them.
We'll go back to our callers now with Jeff in Elkhorn. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Interesting conversation. I'm a high school teacher. I've been for 27 years. And what I'll say is that as long as athletics and extracurriculars are going to dictate the time of school release, this will always be a problem. And I think that is a problem in American education, is that extracurriculars, quote-unquote, have to be done by a certain time, unlike any other nation. And that's really, I think, part of the downfall of American education, is that association, even though I've been with it for all these years, that association with extracurriculars.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So the extracurriculars are the tail wagging the dog, and that dog starts at 7:30 in the morning. Dr. Owens.
Yes. I think there's a lot of validity to the comments about that. And, you know, at the end of the day, kids are in school to get a good education. But their health is also important. And, you know, even from the standpoint of athletics, I mentioned that there is an association between insufficient sleep and a higher rate of sports-related injuries. And, you know, it may be that teams play better when the kids are well-rested. So I think you can make the counter-arguments to that. You know, acknowledging the physical activity and participation in sports is a very valuable part of going through adolescence. But I don't think that you have to give that up in order to get adequate and good amount of sleep.
Back to our callers now with Tara in Middleton. Tara, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
I guess I had a couple comments. I am a mom of a teenager and two other kids, and personally I work really, really hard to make sure they get enough sleep. So I think part of it is parents need to take some responsibility for putting limits in place for that to happen. My other comment is, what's happening around the world with school start times? Is this being seen as an American problem? I would think not if it's a circadian rhythm thing, but what times are other countries starting school?
Well, that's really interesting, Tara. So do we have that kind of comparative data with other countries?
Not to an extensive degree, but for example, many schools in South Korea and Japan, China start very early at the high school levels, and they also the school day is much longer. So it's not a problem that's unique to the United States. And I appreciate and applaud the comment about parental involvement. This is certainly not all about changing school start times. There has to be some degree of personal responsibility on the part of the teenager, and also parents to take that cell phone, away from the teen who's texting all through the night, to not give them the car keys when they're too tired to drive. So I totally agree that that needs to go hand in hand with these kinds of policy changes.
A comment from Jessica. She says, I often wonder why this country is so obsessed with early morning. As an adult, I have trouble going to bed early enough, and I'm a terrible morning person. I need 2 to 3 hours just to fully wake up in the morning, and I don't want to have to get up just at 4 so I can make it to work at 8 fully alert. Do these problems that we may start in our teenage years with sleep and our early morning schedule keep going when we're adults?
I think there are individuals who clearly are at either end of the spectrum. They tend to be definitive night owls or what we call morning larks. And there is a trend as we age to go from being more of a night owl to being more of a morning lark. But there also are, we believe, genetic susceptibilities to those extremes as well. So it's very hard to fight your body's intrinsic circadian rhythms. And we know that from observing shift workers, for example, who have higher rates of high blood pressure, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and even certain types of cancer. So as human beings, we're hardwired to sleep and be awake at certain times. And if we don't do that, there oftentimes is a price to pay.
Dr. Owens, the school start day for most of Wisconsin is next week, Tuesday, a week from today. The school start time is going to be what it's going to be. Advice for parents and teens who have that early wake up.
Well, certainly petition your school, get a grassroots organization going to open up a dialogue with the superintendent and the school board about this, and being armed with some of the scientific information, I think, will be very important. But, at the end of the day, taking sleep seriously as a health imperative is really important, and it should be right up there with physical activity, good nutrition, and all the other things we do for our kids to keep them healthy and safe.
Dr. Owens, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Judith Owens, Director of Sleep Medicine at Children's National Health System. Time for our weekly Teach Me What You Know segment. Last week, we learned how to cut the cord with our TV service. This week, we turn our sights to fantasy football. With the NFL season kicking off next week, millions of fantasy football fans are getting ready to draft their teams. Some players are going to be doing it for the very first time. What do you need to know to avoid getting smoked by your friends and family? Here to teach us how to win our fantasy football leagues is Joe Dykin. He's the founder of FantasyFootballNerd.com. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, Joe, can you give us a quick taste of what fantasy football is and how it works for people who haven't done it before?
Sure. So 26 million people are going to play fantasy football this year. It's a game where you draft real NFL players to be on a fake team. You play against other people, strangers, friends, family, coworkers, very popular in the office. Each week you play against someone in your league, and you earn points based upon what the NFL players that you drafted do during the actual live games. So if Aaron Rodgers throws a touchdown, you'll earn 4 points. You'll get 1 point for every 25 yards that he throws. So then when each of your players has played that week, you'll compare the points that your team earned versus your opponent's team, and whoever has the most points wins that week. And then you build up a record throughout the year, and Usually by around week 13, whoever has the best record makes it into the playoffs.
Now, you're obviously a big fantasy football guy. What keeps bringing you back season after season?
Well, I like that the game makes watching NFL games so engaging. It takes the normal 3 hours that you would spend and takes it to a whole new level. It also gets you interested in other games. You know, I would, before I played fantasy football, we'd watch the Packer game, mm-hmm. and that'd be it. But now I watch the afternoon game, the Sunday night, Monday night, Thursday night, because you usually have players going in some of those games.
Yeah, that definitely jazzed up the interest when I did it, too, in those games I wouldn't have cared about otherwise.
Exactly. And the NFL loves this. The number of people who are watching games has gone up exponentially. If you notice, last year, the league actually made it mandatory. Every team now, during the live games on the Jumbotrons, they have to provide fantasy updates.
Wow. Well, let's get into the how to do it. Where do you sign up? How do you do it with strangers, friends? How do you get started?
If you don't have friends that that want to join a league, there are a ton of free leagues that you can go and play and just test the waters. Any of the big sites, Yahoo, ESPN, NFL.com, they all have free games. You can jump on and pick how many people you want to play with, and they'll match you up with a bunch of strangers. If you can, it is so much more fun to play with friends or family. So, you know, put something out on Facebook and say, hey, anybody want to play? You need maybe 8 people minimum, 12 kind of maximum. That's a really good range. Play with friends and family if you get a chance.
All right, now let's get into the advice that's going to help. You're guaranteeing this is going to help us win our season, right?
I absolutely guarantee if you listen to me, you're going to win.
Wow. Okay. Well, draft day is the starting point for a lot of people. We'll cross our fingers on that one.
Right.
So we start with draft day, where we pick our players for the team, the quarterbacks, the other skill positions. What do we need to know about drafting so we don't squander those valuable opening resources there?
So I have quite a few tips. The first one is practice makes perfect. Like everything else in life, the more you practice something, the better you become. So all those sites that I just mentioned, you can go on there and do mock drafts. They're just test drafts that you'll do against other people. The results don't matter. But come draft time, you'll be prepared. You'll know how it works, and you know which guys are available in which rounds. Always do some research. You know, have a cheat sheet prepared. As each player's drafted, cross them off your list. Most drafts give you a minute to a minute 30 to make a pick. So don't waste time hemming and hawing over which player to take. Nobody's going to be impressed with the amount of thought you put into your pick. So have a couple of guys lined up that you're ready to draft. When you're drafting, the first two rounds are all about safety. That's where you're looking for the studs like Jamal Charles and Adrian Peterson. Middle rounds are about kind of filling out your roster. And the final rounds are all about value. That's where you're looking for lottery tickets.
And you need to dig kind of deep. You can't just know the star players in the league because once you get past those first few rounds, you're looking at names that aren't the marquee players.
Right. The first two, three, maybe in four rounds are very easy. And, of course, I'm going to be a little biased. Fantasy Football Nerd provides a ton of those kinds of tools for especially the newbie player where you may not know all the names of the people you should be looking at. It does all that for you, and it recommends people to draft.
Okay, so that's draft day. Now it's the regular season. Each week we need to set our roster. We've got more than enough players to account for injuries, bye weeks, that sort of thing. What do we keep in mind when we're setting up that roster each week?
So each week you're going to pay attention to whether or not the guy's injured. Obviously somebody who's battling turf toe or just got done with the flu is probably not going to perform at the kind of level that you want. The other thing to keep in mind is who's this player going up against? If you are a running back and your running back is going to play against San Francisco or Seattle, they have fantastic run defenses. There was a year where San Fran didn't allow anyone to hit 100 yards until week 17, and that happened to be Marshawn Lynch. Those are the kinds of things that you're looking at. So the matchup, if it's tough, and your backup has a better matchup, maybe that's when you decide to switch them out.
Well, my one good year, my one successful year back when I did fantasy football was when my starting quarterbacks were injured both in week one. And I was looking in the stats like, oh, this Kay Warner, who from St. Louis? Well, it's Kurt Warner. He had a record breakthrough insane year and I won it all. How do we find that diamond in the rough a couple weeks into the season? That guy we never heard of, but might have a lot of potential.
That's where you read up on some of the big news outlets. I mean, we've all put out our sleepers for the year. I'll use an example. So Maurice Jones-Drew is the current running back for the Oakland Raiders, and he is a big fantasy football nut. A couple of years ago, he picked up on this new kid, Arian Foster, and said, you know what, that's my sleeper this year. And you could pick up Arian Foster in round 11 or 12, and Foster ended up blowing up. He was the biggest player that year. Looking for those lottery tickets, those are the guys that aren't starters, but you think they have that opportunity.
So that's the practical football stat side of stuff. How do we have fun with the social side of it? How do we make sure this stays fun?
Okay, so if you're playing with strangers, that's good luck with that. But if you're playing with family and friends or your people in the office, oh my goodness, there are so many things to do. Side bets are great things. If you lose, maybe let the winner pick your team name for the next week. They can be whatever you want. I once beat a guy, and a side bet was for the next day, anytime he was on the phone, including at work, he had to work the word meow into the conversation with every single call.
And you don't work at a pet food store.
No, not even close. And so I, of course, did my part and went to everybody I knew and asked them to call.
That's great.
Lunches are usually kind of the most common side bet.
How do you draw the line? I've heard of something spinning out of control. You want it to be competitive and a lot of good trash talking and those fun side bets. But how do you keep it from getting too competitive?
There isn't a hard and fast rule for that. And there are people out there who are going to take it seriously. I think first and foremost, you got to remember that this is a game. It's meant to be fun. If you are some of those people who are putting money on the games, that takes it to a totally different level. I wouldn't recommend that until you're really comfortable. Have fun with it. The game is supposed to be fun. Enjoy it. Football season goes by way too fast, and it'll be January before you know it. Time to chill out.
Week one is around the corner. What are you looking for? What signs and portents for our draft days and our week one rosters are you keeping an eye on now?
I think for week one, we're just looking at certain things like LeSean McCoy is battling turf toe. We want to make sure that isn't going to impact him too bad. He's a number one pick, sometimes going number one overall. We're looking at guys like Monty Ball, who had his appendix removed earlier this year. We want to make sure that he is going to be in top shape. You've got guys like Josh Gordon, who got himself in trouble again, suspended this year, but could possibly play part of the year. That's a storyline that we're watching for the next week or two. Otherwise, it's health related. Week one is a clean slate. There's not a whole lot to watch for week one.
And Joe, I got to ask, how many leagues are you in? How many teams are you juggling this season? You lost count?
My wife will shudder when I answer this. 13.
13 different leagues. You've got what? 13 players per league or so. Yeah. Wow. How do you have room for anything else in your brain?
My wife would tell you I don't.
All right, we'll leave it there. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it, Rob.
That's Joe Dykin. He's the founder of FantasyFootballNerd.com, teaching us what he knows about how to win our fantasy football leagues. On next week's edition of Teach Me What You Know, we'll learn how to drill. We'll find out how to pick a drill, what bits to use for which jobs, and more.